Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Kristen Esperlan looks into E85 ethanol and why it's still less efficient than gasoline. First, public transportation in Louisville is getting more expensive. On July 1st, the Transit Authority of River City, better known as TARC, will raise its fares 25 cents, and effective August 24th, some services will be cut. Officials say both measures approved last week by the TARC board are necessary to offset soaring fuel prices. Gabe Bullard reports.
Jasmine Bischoff and Manny Espinoza recently waited for a bus at 4th and Chestnut Streets. Both are regular bus riders who say TARC needs to enhance services, not reduce them.
I feel like on the weekends, I have to wait about an hour sometimes.
I don't think they got the best service in the world.
TARC Executive Director Barry Barker says more people are joining Bischoff and Espinoza on the bus in response to higher gas prices.
What we're seeing, and again, these are preliminary numbers, but that the ridership on the express bus routes is up 20%. And I'm getting, you know, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that I'm getting of folks sending me emails and calling me, telling me about how crowded the bus is and so forth.
Barker says it will cost TARC a lot more in the coming year to keep those buses running.
We're looking at the cost of our budget, our fuel budget, going from about $6 million to $10 million.
Barker's office is filled with stacks of graphs and pie charts analyzing budgets and fuel costs. He's been gathering data to negotiate a price with TARC's bulk diesel fuel provider.
There's not any other aspect that feels more like Las Vegas about our budgeting process.
Every year, TARC pays a fixed price per gallon for diesel fuel. Last year, it was $2.41.
Which we thought was high when we got into it last July. And right now, I'd do just about anything to get that same price.
Back in March, TARC estimated it would pay $3.22 per gallon in the next contract. But now it looks like the price will be more than $4 per gallon when they renew in July. To offset the sharp increase, TARC's board voted to raise fares and cut the frequency and number of stops on certain routes. Barker says deciding which routes to cut was difficult.
Broadway, Preston, 4th Street, some of those routes have too many people on them.
Barker would like to save fuel costs by putting more gas-electric hybrid buses on the street, but he says they're too expensive to buy on a tight budget.
Because of high gas prices, we should be in a position to be offering more service to folks, more frequency, quicker trips, and we don't have the resources to do that, and our fuel bill's going out of sight.
And it's not TARC's fault.
David Coit is the vice president of CART, the Coalition for the Advancement of Regional Transportation. He puts more of the blame for TARC's predicament on Metro government. TARC gets a large portion of its funding through a piece of the occupational tax. Coit says an increase in that levy is long overdue.
Anybody that has a real understanding of the permanence of these oil prices and the impacts these prices are going to have on our economy should be, standing up and jumping down yelling for it, because if our people can't afford to get around, the economy comes to a standstill.
TARC also gets money from the federal government and the Kentucky and Indiana state governments. Indiana and the feds both annually increase their funding for public transit. Kentucky doesn't have increases built into its budget. TARC's Barry Barker says until its financial picture improves, the bus system will be at the mercy of an unpredictable diesel market.
We've got a couple of people in our purchasing department that are becoming fuel futures experts. And I'm developing much more of a expertise on it than I ever thought I would.
For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Gas prices continue to climb past the $4 mark. Alternatives to gasoline are becoming more available, but not enough to make them more attractive and less expensive than gasoline. Kristen Esperlan reports.
These days, it costs me about $50 to fill up my gas tank. If the price of regular unleaded gasoline goes up a penny, say from $4 to $4.01, it might cost me $50 and some change. But what if you're gassing up nearly a quarter of a million vehicles?
To the Postal Service, that's an additional $8 million a year in expenses for just one penny.
Postal Service spokesman Mark Saunders says when you operate the world's largest civilian fleet of vehicles, you want to squeeze every bit out of every gallon of fuel. The Postal Service bought about 40,000 flex fuel vehicles. They can run on gasoline or a gasoline ethanol blend, called E85. It's 15% gas and 85% ethanol, which is mostly made from corn. It does burn quite a bit cleaner than regular gasoline, but recently the Postal Service weighed the costs and benefits of using E85, and they found that first, it's hard to find. Only about 1% of filling stations actually carry it. Second, Saunders says the service found it's less efficient than gas.
Right now, gasoline seems to be, when you look at miles per gallon versus the cost of E85, gasoline still tends to be a more economical means of purchase.
A gallon of ethanol has about two-thirds the energy content of a gallon of gas. Basically, that means you have to fill your tank more often if you're running on E85. AAA reports it's cheaper than gas, but E85 actually costs much more when you factor in fuel efficiency. And with floods devastating the corn crop of the nation's biggest corn-producing state, Iowa, the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association predicts the price of ethanol will only climb as resources grow scarce. So for now, most of the Postal Service's flex fuel vehicles are running on gasoline until they can find an alternative fuel that's both affordable and efficient. Department of Energy biofuels scientist Zia Haque says the best alternatives will likely not come from corn.
We are not doing any R&D on corn ethanol technology, but we think that the second generation cellulosic ethanol technology is indeed sustainable because it utilizes waste materials like corn stover and other agricultural waste as well as forest residues.
Haque says the department is working on developing engines that make better use of high ethanol blends, as well as finding ways to pipe it to more regions of the country. But for now, the future is in E10. That's a gasoline and ethanol blend, which is already in about half the nation's gas supply, including right here in Jefferson County. Iowa State agricultural economist Chad Hart says E10 is more efficient, and it actually helps the pocketbook.
The existence of the ethanol industry reduces your cost by, say, an average of 30 cents a gallon.
Hart says that using E10 in all of the nation's gas supply would require about 14 billion gallons of ethanol a year. Right now, we're producing about half that. But he says using that much ethanol won't be enough to reduce our dependence on fossil fuel.
The federal government has targeted roughly 36 billion gallons of biofuels by 2022. Ethanol at an E10 blend cannot get you nearly that far. And so you have to look at how are we going to go beyond E10.
Hart says ethanol is no silver bullet. It takes a lot of resources to grow corn, and it's still not as efficient as gas.
What we're figuring out is with ethanol, with biofuels, like almost everything in life, there are trade-offs. And I think, you know, with biofuels, they were sold as being our way to get ourselves off of foreign oil and then move ourselves along to energy independence, and that's a very tall order.
An order, Hart says, that will require many alternative fuels and conserving energy. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
A recent poll released by Rasmussen Reports found that just 17% of voters polled nationwide believe reporters try to give unbiased coverage of election campaigns. The statistics raise a number of questions about the quality and fairness of reporters covering this year's presidential race. Kentucky Public Radio's Dan Modlin spoke with Scott Rasmussen, the president of Rasmussen Reports.
First, Mr. Rasmussen, I understand that a significant majority of those polled believe most reporters try to help the candidate they want to win.
That's true. 68% hold that view, four times as many as the number who say they think the reporters are offering unbiased coverage. So this is not a narrow decision. Voters just assume the people they're seeing on TV or the reports they're reading have some agenda behind them.
And the poll had some interesting findings regarding which candidates seem to be getting more favorable coverage.
Well, the most favorable coverage, at least in the minds of the public, went to Barack Obama so far this year, and the worst treatment went to Hillary Clinton. And as we look forward to the fall campaign, 44% believe the reporters will try to help Barack Obama. Only 13% think that most of the media will be trying to help John McCain.
Let's talk a little bit about how the polling is done. What kind of question leads to these results?
These questions questions are part of a general survey that we do on election attitudes, and we ask people, first of all, about their general preferences and party affiliations. And so they're thinking about politics, but we then simply go straight into it and ask very directly. We try to be succinct in our questions, let them hear the options, and then get right to it. Yeah, there's not a series of questions about, did you know that this report was accused of being false or that sort of thing. We're aiming for gut reactions from people.
As you know, for years there have been allegations of a bias in the news media. Do you think that belief in general contributes to these numbers in terms of people believing that reporters are biased?
Absolutely. And I think one of the other things that's contributed to it has been the proliferation of news sources, because now people are able to watch the news that seems to reflect their view of the world, and they recognize that there are different approaches. In fact, survey research we did 4 years ago found that overwhelmingly people who preferred CNN as their news source voted for John Kerry, and people who watched Fox as their news source preferred George W. Bush. So there was a strong connection.
Do you expect that to continue in the future as the networks try to carve out their own demographics?
Absolutely. I think what we're entering into is a phase where there is so much information available via the internet, via local stations, and via a variety of cable networks, that the only way you'll be able to retain an audience is to find a niche and provide them with information that is not necessarily that they like to hear, but that is relevant to what they're talking about. You know, if you are a conservative Republican this year, you are more likely to be interested in judicial appointments than a liberal Democrat who is more likely to be interested in the war on Iraq. And so the networks are going to have to be catering to that a little bit to keep their audience.
As a result, do you believe viewers who want to find an unbiased, fair source of news may be somewhat challenged in the future?
Very challenged. I think if you are looking to find an unbiased source of news, what you're going to have to do is create your own set of inputs. You're going to have to watch several networks or look for several websites to get the information you want. To some degree, it's the same situation we find in polling. We know, for example, if we ask people about the importance of issues and we use the description, the war in Iraq, Democrats are more likely to say that's important. If we use the phrase national security, Republicans are more likely to select that. And we're often asked as a polling firm, how do you get the fair question? How do you find the perfect question? And what we have concluded is that you can't. We have to ask the questions from several different perspectives and put the information out there and acknowledge those distinctions.
There are some interesting variations here in this poll about attitudes toward reporting quality by party line. I understand Republicans had apparently the lowest viewpoint of the objectivity of the reporters.
Yes, and that's something that has been true for a long time. You know, Republicans, prior to the advent of talk radio, really believed that all of the media was biased against them. And we had in the 1980s the rise of people like Rush Limbaugh, and then in the 90s the beginning of something like Fox News. But most Republicans tend to view those as specialized media as opposed to the mainstream media. So the Republicans continue to not only believe that media is more biased, but 87% of Republicans believe that the media has too much influence over the process. Only 65% of Democrats agree.
So it's not necessarily good news for the news business in terms of the Democratic numbers, but the Democrats are a little less critical than the Republicans.
A little less pessimistic, that's right.
And what about the independents?
Well, the independents are actually closer to the Republicans at this point in time. 80% of unaffiliated say that the media has too much influence in this process, and they're just not likely to see them as unbiased. In fact, if we ask along an ideological scale instead of a partisan scale, the political moderates, those people who are supposed to be in the middle, have numbers almost the same as the overall population. 65% say that most reporters are trying to help a candidate, only 17% of moderates say they're trying to be objective. And by the way, this to me is a healthy part of the discussion. They present a view that people are not taking for granted that everything they hear in the media is accurate. They are applying some level of scrutiny to it. And while reporters may want to believe it's excessive, I think it is better that people be skeptical of information they receive rather than the opposite extreme. And one other piece that this data helps explain, a lot of people on the political left have been frustrated. They can't understand why people would treat Fox News as a legitimate news source. They will bring up things perhaps that Fox has done done that they can prove are inaccurate. Well, what they're really saying here is that Fox, like all the other networks, are graded on a curve. They expect that Fox is biased. They expect that CNN is biased. They expect that NPR is biased. This is part of the way Americans are viewing the media culture today.
In a sense, there's been kind of a blurring of the lines between journalists, commentators, and talk shows in recent years. Do you think that also may have contributed to this somewhat in terms of how people define the news media?
I think it has. The blurring of the lines, as you describe it, and again, it goes even further when you get onto the internet and you have blogs that are providing information but also are strongly opinion-based. Ultimately, it gets back to the fact that there's more information out there. If you went back to the 1960s, we all had free networks we could watch, and when the President of the United States spoke on television, we all watched because there were no other options. While there may have been rumblings about coverage, there weren't really alternatives available. Now what happens is there are so many choices, and by the way, every journalist, every human makes mistakes. None of us are perfect. And so it is very easy to point out mistakes that some network has made because of information from another news source. And the more that happens, the more I think it destroys credibility. And the more that happens, I think the partisan activists are looking to blame a bias rather than an honest mistake. I can tell you from our own work, when we release a poll that shows good news for a Democrat, we get lots of emails grumbling about it from Republicans telling us about our bias. Then when we show the opposite result, we get emails that word for word are almost exactly the same, except for they flip the words Republicans and Democrats and accuse us of bias in the opposite direction. And again, I think that's what happens with a lot of media coverage when mistakes are made.
Do you think there are lessons to be learned from this poll for people in the news business?
I think there are lessons to be learned from this poll and many others that have been done. I think there is a serious lack of confidence in the reporters, and I think it needs to be addressed. In some cases, it may be that we simply have to go back to acknowledging that reporters have a viewpoint and being upfront about it, and that might be, while it sounds like a step backwards from impartial journalism, simply acknowledging the people who are in the process and what interests they have, I think that could be a help. But beyond that, I think the question is going to be changed a lot in the coming years. I have no idea what the media will look like 5 years from today. We know that younger people are getting more and more of their information from sources that didn't even exist a decade ago. We know that the brand names of newspapers don't carry over automatically onto the online world. We know, quite frankly, the younger generation doesn't listen to radio, and television is taking a different seat. So somehow, we're going to have to begin to develop a way to sort out quality information, and people who are providing the information need to be very mindful of that.
That was Kentucky Public Radio's Dan Modlin speaking with Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Reports. When we come back, I'll chat with Dan Fox of the Louisville agency Families and Children First. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Elizabeth Kramer traveled to Western Kentucky recently for the Jefferson Davis Bicentennial Celebration. Her report is coming up. First, one of Louisville's oldest charitable organizations is marking its 125th anniversary this year. I spoke with the executive director of Family and Children First, Dan Fox, about the milestone. Let's start by getting a little history of your organization. What is Family and Children First?
Well, Family and Children First is one of the largest nonprofits, social service organizations in this area that has been helping children and families for the past 125 years.
And it began as something else 125 years ago.
It was called the Charity Organization Society, and when it was founded, it gave out relief to families that were struggling and poor. And over the years, it's evolved to provide different types of programs and services.
And you've been through a number of name changes since then.
We have. Currently, Family and Children First. We adopted our current name about 4 or 5 years ago. We feel like it just really says what we're about, and that's families and kids, and that's who we put first.
So who do you serve here in Louisville, and how many people do you serve?
This year, there'll be about 3,800 families that come through our various programs and services. They come from all over Metro Louisville, the surrounding counties in Kentucky, as well as five counties up in southern Indiana, but primarily from Floyd and Clark County in southern Indiana. The families come from every part of the community, but they tend to have similar some basic issues that they're dealing with, mental health issues, problems with violence and abuse and neglect. And our families tend to be struggling financially. The average income for our families that we see is about $15,000 a year.
What are the numbers looking like? Is there hope? Are you optimistic? Are the numbers going up, going down at this point?
Our numbers have stayed fairly steady over the last couple years. We haven't seen a dip. Some of the services that we provide, the numbers go up somewhat, but we've remained steady, and the need, that means to me that the need is remaining steady.
You have a number of sites across the area, don't you?
We do. We have five service locations that we operate out of, one in St. Matthews, behind the mall in St. Matthews. We have one out near the old, or near a Jewish hospital out in Southwest Jefferson County. We have one on 31st and Broadway, an office up in New Albany, and then one office downtown.
Now, you are a nonprofit organization. Are you feeling the pinch of the current economic times?
Definitely. For most nonprofits, each year brings its own financial challenges. This year, for Family and Children First, as it has for a lot of nonprofits, it's some real significant challenges. State of Kentucky was in financial situations this year where they've had to reduce funding. The United Way, which we depend heavily on, has had to reduce funding because the campaign fell short. And Metro Louisville is also looking at reducing funding. So we're looking at some real financial challenges this year.
So you have to do some belt tightening.
Doing belt tightening, but our board met and considered our budget for this next year, which starts July 1st for us, and pledged themselves to, rather than just cutting services, to redouble their efforts to raise money on their own to keep our services afloat.
Money from the private sector or just across the board?
Well, they're talking about private fundraising from individuals and corporations. So
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about your prevention programs.
Yeah, one of the key things that we're involved with is prevention, particularly in the area of child abuse. We have a cooperative arrangement with the Metro Louisville Health Department, and we operate what is called the HANDS program, which is for first-time parents. And in that program, we're working with parents prenatally, and we go into the home on a weekly basis and help them with child development, basic how to be a parent, how to keep your home safe for your child. We provide them emotional support, get them connected with other resources in the community. And we'll work with a parent for up to 2 years to make sure the child gets off to a good start. And we know that that program reduces child abuse. The parents and families participating in that have a much lower rate of child abuse than the general population does. So we know that it works. We also have launched a new child abuse prevention effort in cooperation with an organization called ECHO, Exploited Children's Help Organization, and the University of Louisville Kent School of Social Work. And it's called the Partnership to Prevent Child Abuse, and we're providing just a number of evidence-based prevention services, classes throughout the community. This is a federally funded program and will last about another year and a half. And our effort is to work with adults to help them understand what they can do to keep children safe. So the focus really is on educating adults about the need for child safety.
I see. On a lighter note, you're having some anniversary events this week and beyond?
This is our 125th anniversary, and next week, next Thursday, we're having a 125th party for the longtime supporters of Family and Children First. And then we have some other events coming up later in the year. In November, we have what we call the Family Reunion Breakfast at the end of November, which will be sort of the culminating event for our anniversary.
I see. Well, Dan Fox of the Family and Children First organization, thanks for joining us today.
Well, I really appreciate it.
This year saw the launch of celebrations marking President Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday coming up in 2009. This month, people in several states are celebrating the 200th birthday of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America during the Civil War. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer went to his birthplace to find out more.
Well, this is the Jefferson Davis Monument. It is 351 feet tall and 8 inches.
This obelisk was built in 1917 at Jefferson Davis's birthplace to commemorate the native son of Fairview in southwestern Kentucky. Hundreds of visitors are here, and some are taking the elevator up to see the view. Below are dozens of Civil War reenactors who are camped out and clad in period clothing in 90-degree heat. The crowd is here to remember Davis with artillery demonstrations and speeches by Davis's descendants. Davis Webb is one. He calls his ancestor one of the most misunderstood men in American history.
He was president of the Confederacy. The Confederacy lost the war. He owned slaves. And those are the two things that people know about him.
Webb details his forefathers' achievements as a military leader in the Mexican-American War, a U.S. Senator and Secretary of War from 1853 to 57 under President Franklin Pierce. Webb's cousin, Bertram Hayes Davis, says recognizing his great-great-grandfather doesn't mean supporting slavery or racism. It means putting history in perspective.
I think it's important for people to understand that you don't change history. The institution of slavery was not acceptable any time in a public interest. However, it was part of the society then. We cannot go back and change what we've seen, but we can learn from it.
For some here, the lesson is that the Civil War continues in the battle for stronger states' rights. One believer is James Ronald Kennedy. He's on the lawn signing books he co-authored, including one called Was Jefferson Davis Right?
Jefferson Davis and all of his men and women that followed him into the Confederacy were fighting for limited government, constrained by the strictures of a written constitution. Now, obviously, we didn't win this time around.
What do you mean by this time around?
It ain't over, honey. It ain't over.
Those feelings are echoed by members of the League of the South. It's a Southern nationalist organization that the Southern Poverty Law Center designated as a hate group in 2000. The center calls its members neo-Confederates. Ewan Haig is a professor at DePaul University and writes about neo-Confederates.
A lot of neo-Confederates argue that the trajectory of the United States and the Constitution as established by the Founding Fathers was ripped apart by Lincoln. So Lincoln acted as a war criminal in an aggressive, offensive war, and ever since then, the United States has acted in an unconstitutional manner.
Haig says the League of the South formed in 1994, and their ranks grew until the 2001 terrorist attacks. Then members began joining the Sons of the Confederate Veterans, a Southern heritage group. The new members began voicing extremist and sometimes racist views, causing long-standing members to leave. Haig says neo-Confederates are promoting their ideas via conservative think tanks, hoping they will gain traction among prominent politicians. It could be working. This month, Virginia Democratic Senator Jim Webb talked to CNN about his 2004 book that suggests the Civil War was more about state sovereignty than slavery. Likewise, admirers of Jefferson Davis say his main concern was self-government. Haig says it's an argument that validates these celebrations.
He's not just a hero for Confederates, he's a hero for all Americans because he was the one that was bravely resisting this usurpation of the Constitution.
But many Southern heritage groups and historians see this anniversary as an opportunity to understand America's past. Historian William J. Cooper, Jr. has written extensively about the Confederate leader.
I think that one should study him and try to understand him. I'm not about celebrating. That's not the point, in my humble opinion. And groups that say the South shall rise again or fly the Confederate flag every place, I don't have any truck with that. I think that's just as bad as people who say, well, we should never study Jefferson Davis because he was a slave owner and fought for slavery.
And what could the attitudes be about Davis in another 100 years? Tony Horowitz, author of the bestseller Confederates in the Attic, says shifts in demography could erode neo-Confederate philosophies. The country has a growing non-white population, and young Americans are less conservative. But Horowitz says that change shouldn't be a reason for Americans to forego in-depth study of the Civil War in Davis.
I don't think history should simply be forgotten. I think it should be remembered, debated, and, you know, honored in most cases. But particularly with the Confederacy, that's a delicate exercise.
That exercise could prove to be very difficult in a country where research shows citizens don't know the facts of American history very well, which gives some people the opportunity to twist the truth. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with Harvard Associate Professor Emeritus Lester Grinspoon about his 40 years of studying marijuana. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Over the past decade, we've been hearing more and more about the medical uses of marijuana. But Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Harvard Associate Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry, has been studying and writing about medical marijuana for more than 40 years. Robin Fisher spoke with Dr. Grinspoon about the uses, misconceptions, and future of medical marijuana.
What happened? You said it was used in the 19th century, early 20th century. And then what happened? Why did that not progress?
Yeah, there are several reasons. One of them was that with the passage of the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, the environment became very difficult. Doctors were still allowed to use it, but it became so cumbersome with paperwork that they just stopped doing it. And secondly, by 1898 and 1900, respectively, the first of the sleeping pills, the first of the barbiturates, was invented. And one of the two reasons that cannabis indica, as it was called when it was dispensed as drops in the 19th century, was one of the two reasons it was used, two primary reasons, I should say, was as a soporific, as a sleeping medicine. And now the doctor could just prescribe a neat pill. He knew the dose. At that time, there were no bioassays for, you know, a liquid form of marijuana because it isn't soluble in water. It had to be in an alcoholic base. You could never tell whether you gave the patient too much or too little and so forth. Now you could prescribe a precise amount for sleep. And the same thing happened when acetyl salicylic acid, or aspirin, was invented at the same time at the turn of the century. Now you could put into a nice little pill, you knew exactly the dose, and it would relieve pain. just as cannabis did as the second most important reason it was prescribed by doctors at that time. And so it wasn't just the legislation, but it was also, this was a much neater way to do things. Now, as it turns out, we're now learning, we knew nothing about smoking cannabis as a medicine at that time, but we know a lot about it now. And whereas doctors in the 19th centuries might say, well, I'm going to have you take three minims of cannabis indica before you go to sleep, he wouldn't know whether he was giving you an underdose or an overdose. This way, if you prescribe, if you are a patient who suffers from, let's say, neuropathic pain or migraine or one of the many things for which this is useful as an analgesic, you can, by virtue of the fact that the when you smoke it, it goes. It doesn't go through the liver. It isn't transported. It goes directly to the brain. You get an almost immediate effect, and so you can stop as soon as you get there. In fact, with my older patients who are have had no experience with marijuana, some of them not even with tobacco smoking, I tell them, look, you've got to have someone there to teach you how to use this. You get a grandchild or someone, and you take a puff on this while you, let's say she's trying to treat her nausea, as a patient I had not long ago from Florida wanted to do. I said, and you take a puff and just let it go out. And then wait 2 or 3 minutes. And then take another puff. And even if the cigarette goes out, the joint goes out, just wait a while. And just do that until one of two things happens. You get release of your nausea or you get anxious. At that point, stop.
Well, let's talk about the trade-offs between the benefits of the drug and the negative effects of smoking.
All right, let's talk about that. First of all, what are the negative effects of smoking? You know, everybody talked about lung cancer, and when my book came out and I claimed there was no evidence that it caused lung, people jumped on me because, after all, in 71, we hadn't been smoking marijuana that long. You know, it started in the 60s in this country. But here we are, it's 4 decades, and there's not been a single case of lung cancer or emphysema or oral cancer of any kind. Now, we do smoke. We do live in an anti-smoking environment now. A lot of people just don't like smoke and don't want to. But you see, what's come along also in the last few years is a device called a vaporizer. What a vaporizer does, you put the herbal marijuana, little bit of it, in a chamber, and this instrument holds the temperature, even as you breathe it in, between something like 285 degrees Fahrenheit and 450 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, nature endowed herbal marijuana with a temperature window, which if the marijuana is exposed to these little 21 carbon drugs, molecules called cannabinoids, pop off, they vaporize, and they get in the air that you're breathing in. But unless you go above that, say above 450 degrees, the ignition point of this herbal marijuana is about 460 degrees Fahrenheit. So as long as it holds it below that, nothing burns. You get a bag full of these little cannabinoids, and not just tetrahydrocannabinol, but other ones as well. You breathe that in, and you don't breathe any smoke. When you're finished with this, you take the chamber out, and you can see this has not been ignited. This has not burned. The little, you know, you're chopping the little particles, they've changed color, but they haven't burned. And indeed, tests that have now, that this has been taken into the laboratory, and it confirms just what one would suppose happens. The, for example, there are things called PAHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbon. Those are reduced to a tiny fraction of what they are in smoke. There is no evidence of any carcinogen getting through. Not that there is in whole smoke marijuana, even if you don't use a vaporizer, because the only thing you can get from smoking marijuana, and you have to smoke a lot of it to get a chronic bronchitis, which means you have a cough. There's some inflammation of the bronchi, of the tubes that bring the air down into the lungs. And nobody has ever died of that. So even that is bogus. There's no question about it. This is a remarkably non-toxic drug.
How is it used medically or viewed by other countries?
Well, in other countries, for example, you can get it fulfilled at a drugstore. You can get herbal marijuana in the Netherlands for medical uses if you have the permission of a doctor. In fact, in this country now, in 12 states, beginning with California, with Proposition 215, which was passed in 1996, if you have a letter from a doctor that reads something like, my patient so-and-so suffers from Crohn's disease, the best medicine for him is marijuana. You can then take that to the state agency that allows that letter to be translated into a card, which will then present, when you present it at a marijuana dispensary, they will give you marijuana to use for the treatment of your Crohn's disease or your multiple sclerosis or your migraine, or there are so many different things for which it is now used medicinally. And that's now true not just in California, but since 1996, there are now 12 states where it's legal to use it as a medicine along the same lines with the doctors signing off. Now, unfortunately, the federal government, particularly the present administration, is trying to crack down and go around the state laws. For example, there's a case I've just written an affidavit for in California of two people they want to send away for 20 years because they were growing the medicine for marijuana for one of these dispensaries, and all of it was going to the dispensary. Now, there's no question about it. There are people who can go to a doctor and say, doctor, I have a pain in my back, and so forth. And some of them, you know, will give them the letter they need to do this. People will abuse anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, in my view, that's one of the reasons why it has to be, the prohibition has to give way to regulation. It has to be regulated like alcohol. You know, alcohol at one time was a kind of medicine. That's why when I was a kid, you could buy alcohol in the drugstore on Sunday. That was left over. That was the only place you could get it. And this is what it's going to have to be regulated. You can keep it away from youngsters better if it's regulated. I mean, just as we're making a much more successful effort to keep alcohol out of the hands of young people, and you can tax it. And it will be less expensive, even with the taxes, than it is on the street, because on the street you have what I call the prohibition tariff. You know, it's these people take such risks to sell it on the street, they get a lot of money for it, more than it's ultimately worth in terms of you know, the kind of resources that go into producing it.
Well, Dr. Grinspoon, what do you think is the fear surrounding medical marijuana?
You know, Robin, that is such a good question. Nobody really knows. There are two authors recently who, Peter Webster and Peter Cohen, both in different parts of Europe, who have written about the fact that it's treated like something, the fear of it is treated as a kind of sacred tenet. I mean, it doesn't give way to any kind of, I mean, if you look at the literature, as I have done since 1967, now there's papers that say all sorts of things, like, you know, the belief in marijuana as leading to a lung cancer was much abetted by a man by the name of Tashkin in California, at the University of California, who said it contained four times as much tyrosine. He published this in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think it was about somewhere in the 80s, I guess the 80s, the early 90s. Well, now he's done a larger, definitive study. And he, the man on whom the government relied on for their constantly saying, you know, it leads to lung cancer, he now, as a result of his last study, says absolutely it does not lead to lung cancer. In fact, the odds ratios were a little bit on the negative side, and people have wondered if maybe it has some protective effect, but that's just sheer speculation. What is known is that it isn't that way, but nevertheless, we keep generating this stuff. Now, if you ask me, you know, what's behind this? Well, I really don't know. But consider, you know, the fact that you remember when Eisenhower spoke of the military, his fear of the military-industrial complex as he was going out of office, you know, that so much of our money was being spent on military hardware, that he was afraid there are vested interests in keeping this going now, even after the Cold War is over, which it wasn't, of course, at that time, but he was afraid that that would... Well, I think that we have a kind of marijuana industrial complex. That is to say, there are so many people whose livelihoods depend on this prohibition. If you think of everything from all the new district attorneys and sheriffs and DEA agents and prison builders and so forth and so on. And even if you think of the people who sell it illegally, I mean, they would go out of business. There's a lot of vested interest. Another possibility is that, you know, in the 60s, a lot of conservative people were very concerned about the kind of movements that were going on, the civil rights movements, the free speech movement, and so forth and so on, the anger with authority and so. And I think a lot of them concluded that marijuana and psychedelic drugs had a lot to do with that.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Harvard Associate Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry, about medical marijuana. Dr. Grinspoon is the author of Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine. Louisville will be home to the 8th Annual Lester Grinspoon Day on Tuesday. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL 101.5.